Access number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 7. Now, we were talking about this process of crewing up while you were at 16, Operational Training Unit. Now, how exactly did you go about it? You told me a bit about the process, but now, what happened to you?
Well, during these communal lectures, during the breaks, during the intermingling in aircraft hangars, I was approached by two gunners, one small, thin, tobacco-stained, mustachioed Scot, the other average size, quiet lad from the Birmingham area. They had chummed up and they were looking for a skipper. They said, "Could we join your crew, sir?" I said, "Yes, certainly."
So this is a rear gunner and a mid-upper?
Well, at that stage, they would be just two gunners.
And what are their names, if you remember?
Yes. Jeff Osborne.
Jeff with a J?
That was a G.
G.
Jeffrey. Jeff Osborne, who eventually became our mid-upper. And Jimmy Glover, the wee Scot, who became the rear gunner.
And were these sergeants?
They were sergeants. These were sergeant aircrew at the time who had only just finished air gunnery school. Of the two gunners, Jimmy Glover from Glasgow was the more aggressive, if you like. And he spoke for the other chap. And they decided I was going to be their skipper.
Now, this two-way process, though. What did you like about them? I mean, they were obviously inexperienced. They were straight out of gunnery school. They weren't... You could have been looking for a second tour man, or, you know...
Well, there were no second tour chaps on that course. They were all young. Both of these chaps were 19.
So what was it about them rather than the others?
Well, I really didn't get a choice because the majority of the pilots on the course were Australian, who had their sort of nice dark blue uniform and were by and large somewhat older than the RAF pilots. And it was noticeable that the air gunners and wireless ops made a beeline for the Australians. For some reason or other, I think they thought they would be better pilots than British pilots. That's how it seemed to me anyway. So, and as I knew nothing about their background, one couldn't get an idea of what their records were like as gunners. It was really potluck. So they were cheerful chaps anyway, and, you know, you could get to like them fairly quickly. And the big thing was they wanted me. I mean, here was someone who actually wanted me, wanted to fly with me.
So
they then introduced a wireless operator to me.
Another sergeant.
Another sergeant.
Yes.
Another sergeant, wireless operator. Charlie Flint. He was a Londoner, sharp-witted, of Italianate appearance, although he wasn't. One for the girls, he told me. So suddenly I had two gunners and a wireless operator, and I now needed a navigator and a bomb aimer. The bomb aimer was fairly easy. I was approached by an elderly looking flight lieutenant bomb aimer, air bomber, with a heavy moustache, and he appeared to be in the early 30s. He introduced himself as Stan Williams, and I thought, my God, this fellow must be experienced. Stanley had trained in Canada as a bomb aimer, and because of his ability, he was kept back as an instructor. And Stan had been instructing in Canada as a bomb aimer for 2 years, and eventually he'd been returned to go on to operations. Stan said he picked me out because I looked more experienced than the rest, and he was looking for a good, safe chap to fly with. I was flattered and said, "Fine, join up." He said, "I've got another guy for you, a navigator." I said, what's he like? He said, well, he's the most experienced navigator in England at the time. I said, how do you mean? He said, well, when this chap graduated as a navigator, instead of staying in the RAF, he was seconded to British Overseas Airways. And he has been flying for 2 to 3 years from Cairo to South Africa, flying in flying boats backwards and forwards for nearly 3 years. And therefore, he's got more hours under his belt than the rest of the navigators on this course put together. You couldn't. So suddenly I had Sprog gunners and wireless operator, but I had two of the most experienced guys.
And what was his name, the navigator?
The navigator was, well, let me think again, Cliff. Cliff, I don't think I'll mention his surname for a reason which will become clear later on.
Okay, that's no problem.
He was a thin little chap with a dark moustache, newly commissioned. He'd been given a commission when he returned to the RAF to go on ops. Once I had soloed on the Wellington.
Now, now's the time to talk to you about the Wellington.
Yeah.
But everything you can remember about the Wellington as an aircraft.
Well, the Wellington
this
was...
This is the 3 and the 10, was it? Mark 3.
Mark 3 and the Mark 10.
I don't know if you can cover the differences between them.
Well, the difference between the Mark 3 and 10 was very little. It depended on the particular mark of Hercules engine they had. Whereas the difference between the 310 and the 1 was significant. The 1 was an early Wellington, which had lower powered aircraft, air engines, and was used by the RAF in the beginning of the war. To upgrade it, the Hercules engines were produced, and the aircraft became a very significant part of Bomber Command, its largest component.
Now, what was it like? But in every way.
It was the Wellington was a unique aircraft. It had been designed mainly by Barnes Wallis, and it was of geodetic construction. Without going into detail, this was really, instead of having the normal system of formers, stringers, and metal cladding, a monocoque system, the geodetic structure was a series of formed metal members which were joined together such that they produced a sort of lattice work, diamond shaped apertures in a lattice of structure. And this was sort of, if you like, the difference between something which was reinforced inside and something akin to an eggshell, where the skin was the strength of the whole. It was 86 foot in wingspan, about 60 foot long. It had a front turret and a rear turret, no mid-upper turret. It was covered in canvas, of course. It wasn't covered in metal. And this made it appear to be a somewhat old-fashioned aircraft, but it wasn't. It was a jolly good aircraft. The wings flapped about. I mean, during flight, you could see the ends of the wingtips going up about 2 feet and down 2 feet because of the type of structure.
Now, what was it like to fly?
Well, it was suddenly from the Oxford, which was, you know, 5,000-6,000 pounds all up weight, we had this thing which, if fully loaded, would be up to 35,000-36,000 pounds. We operated it around about 30,000 pounds. It was a big brute, but it wasn't difficult to fly, except when you put flaps down on the approach. Well, as you put the flaps down, the nose would kick up, and as long as one was ready, it was easy to control the aircraft. And it really was a good aircraft. I had no problems with it, night or day. Most of the flying we did was at night. Obviously, we were going to operate at night, so all our training was done at night.
Now, what were these night flights like?
Well, these were big, long cross-country flights, mainly, with bombing practice at the end or at the beginning. we would collect as a crew and be briefed to where we were going to fly and where we were going to bomb, that is, bomb with practice bombs on a range. These flights would be a 5-6 hours duration and would generally go up the east coast to north of Scotland, across perhaps to Northern Ireland, down the west coast and back to base at near Oxford.
So a real test for the navigator, you know.
Exactly.
And the bomb aimer and everything else.
Now, I had mentioned the pundits, which were a help for navigation, but if there was any cloud, you couldn't see these. So the navigation was done by dead reckoning with the aid of the G system.
Now, what was the G system? That's G-E-E, isn't it?
G-E-E, yes. Now, the G system was a navigational aid. It was wireless rather than radar. It would be difficult to describe it to the layman, inasmuch as that signals were sent from three different stations, and where these crossed, the time difference was measured, and lines were overdrawn on a navigational chart, which in fact were equidistant from a particular station in time, so that when using the small screen which showed the signals, when lined up, a number was produced and could be plotted on the chart. It's very difficult to explain without the chart, and it's very difficult to go into this. It was a very great advance which the RAF had brought in when their early bombing systems had proved inadequate and they were bombing all around the world instead of a German town.
So you were getting used to this system.
Yep.
Presumably the wireless operator, yes, and the navigator working together.
Yes. Now, what this did mean, though, that there was a lot of work for a navigator to do. He had to work quickly. He had to work accurately. And this is what my navigator, Cliff, couldn't or didn't do. Time and time again, we were virtually lost. And as we were operating at 10 to 15,000 feet above cloud in dreadful weather on occasions, this was a pretty dicey do, and the crew were getting somewhat fed up with this guy. It got so bad that we were always late back. We often missed our bombing run on the range. And I saw the navigation leader. The nav leader was the senior instructor for navigators, and said, you know, this guy isn't any good. We want to change him. I was told that this guy was the most experienced navigator in the RAF and that they knew he probably didn't want to go on to operations, but they weren't going to let him go back like to BOAC. He had to go forward, and you guys are going to have to suffer. He's really a great navigator, so don't get too bothered about it. Well, it never improved, and I couldn't get rid of him. And when we finished the course, five of the crew were dissatisfied with the sixth member, the navigator.
So it wasn't just you?
No, the others knew it.
Did you speak to him about it? I mean, did you know him well enough to speak to him?
Oh, yes. I mean, he was a very quiet, withdrawn character. He was married with one child, I think. Bombay was married, and he had two children. So it wasn't that. But he was a very taciturn, withdrawn person, difficult to... He never came out with us when we went out for a drink. He was on his own. He was a loner. And, you know, I would say, well, you know, what's the problem with navigation? In the air sometimes, I, you know, got very cross with him because, you know, we were often 100 miles away from where we should have been. And not only was that stupid, but it was pretty dangerous. I mean, we had to get back and drop down through crowds, clouds, and find the airfield. And he, you know, might well have led us into disaster. It was my job as the skipper, the captain of the aircraft, to ensure that the crew was saved.
Now, was there any question of the crew failing? Because I presume the crew could fail as a group.
Well, yes, but I mean, we got by. I mean, Cliff wanted to get back to base as much as we did. And I was unsure whether the navigation that he had to undertake was too fast for him, having spent several years leisurely flying in daylight down to South Africa from Cairo, following the Nile and the Great Lakes, which any fool could follow from 5,000 or 6,000 feet, in an aircraft proceeding at 120 miles per hour, 120 to 140, whereas flying at 180 miles per hour in pitch dark, in a cramped position, with the, you know, dangers of weather, other aircraft, probably wasn't his cup of tea. Or whether he was just inept, it was all too fast for him. I didn't know the reason. Whatever, we didn't want him, but we couldn't get rid of him. We finished the course.
That would be what, December, January?
November, December.
Oh, November.
November,
yes.
November. Yes. And we were posted to a holding centre to await a further posting to a heavy conversion unit. Heavy conversion units were set up to convert pilots who had flown the Wellington or the Whitley aircraft, twin-engined heavy bombers, onto four-engine heavy bombers, the Lancaster or Halifax, or in earlier times, the Stirling.
Now, so this was 1651 heavy conversion unit.
1651, Wilcox Lodge.
And where's that?
Wilcox Lodge is on the Great North Road near, not far from Grantham.
Now, I've just noticed something that says bullseye in your notes.
Oh yes, a bullseye was a sort of minor operation. It would be when the main force was sent, if you like, towards the Ruhr or southern Germany, a smaller force, often made up of operational training unit aircraft who were fairly advanced on their course. They might fly over the North Sea towards Denmark, hopefully to bring fighters from the main force up to the north to mislead the enemy.
And this was a bullseye, was it?
Yes, they were called bullseye. You're on a bullseye tonight, chaps. Oh.
And would you do more than one of these, or?
I think I only did one, maybe two. I'm not sure.
That was on the 10th of November.
Yeah.
It was just over the North Sea, was it?
Well, as I recall, it was out towards Denmark. We didn't see anything, any activity other than the occasional flash here and there. The weather was poor.
Were you dropping window?
We were not dropping window. They wanted us to be there as a sort of deflector from the main force.
So nothing particular about that other than...
No.
To you, in a wet sense, it was just another flight. Were you in formation or not formation?
Oh, no.
In a stream, or you?
Well, there would be a minor stream, you know. There might be 50 to 100 aircraft up that night.
And most of them trainees?
Most of them, you know, sort of advanced trainees or operational aircraft were sent as well, of course, you know, from... Now, operational squadrons.
Next we'll turn to your time with 1651.
Yes.
Heavy conversion unit. Now, tell me about that. I mean, this is really for you, I suppose, in a sense. This is where you get to learn the new aircraft, the Lancaster.
That's right.
Now, tell me about, what was your impression of the Lancaster?
Well, my first impression was it was even bigger than the Wellington. It was much higher off the ground. I mean, it was about 20 feet when it was standing on the ground up at the front end. But one knew of it. It had a great reputation at the time. And as soon as one flew it, you could see why. It was the most stable, easy aircraft to fly. And yet it was one of the most maneuverable of all the heavy or large aircraft.
Now tell us a bit about flying it. I mean,
well, it was the usual RAF training system. The only difference being that on this, the whole crew were on the aircraft when you practiced circuits and bumps or circuits and landings. First solo, so that, as on the Wellington, in fact, my first solo on the Wellington was taken with the whole crew aboard. My first night solo on the Wellington was taken with the whole crew aboard. So at that stage, though you had few hours, they had to trust you. And this, I think, built up the trust between various members of a crew. On the Lancaster, we did the systems, the usual ground school. Each of the trades, if I can call them tradesmen, concentrated on their particular part of the aircraft. We flew circuits and bumps as a crew with an instructor in the right-hand seat. We went solo together. We did everything together. And it was at this stage when we went on to four-engine aircraft that we picked up an additional crew member, a flight engineer.
Do you remember his name?
Yes. Doug Cuthill was the flight engineer I picked up. Doug was unusual in
Cuthill
the...
Cuthill or...
Cuthill. C-U-T-H-I-L-L.
What was he like? Was he a sergeant? Or
Doug was a flight sergeant. He'd been trained as a pilot in Canada, but had come too late to be considered useful for further training as a pilot because of the way the war was going. And rather than waste the ability of these pilots, they offered them a chance to remuster as air engineers or flight engineers. Doug had accepted this. He'd done his training at the School of Technical Training at South Athlone and had come back and joined us at Woolfox Lodge. I say he joined us. It was the OTU system again where, although we were a complete crew except for flight engineers, a number of flight engineers were introduced and they or we picked a flight engineer. My flight engineer was picked by my gunners, because they dined in the same mess, and it was easy for them to find someone. They thought that having a flight engineer who also could fly an aircraft, was a trained pilot, was a great idea. And I must admit that it seemed a good idea to me. If anything happened to me, there was Doug, he could fly an airplane.
Now, tell me about the development of this crew spirit. I mean, you said it helped, you know, taking your first solos together, in a sense.
Well, I think that bound us together because the crew then learnt that they could trust you. You could take off and land the aircraft. You could fly the aircraft. And
how did the relationship develop? Did it get close socially as well as
professionally? Right from the beginning, I decided that we'd go out as a crew. If we could go down the pub together, then we'd all go. And this was fine. The only person who didn't go was a navigator, who I mentioned earlier. He just didn't want to go. He didn't mix. He just joined us for the flight and disappeared after a flight. When I got to the point of doing cross countries on the Lancaster, I again went to the nav leader there and told him my problem with Cliff and said he really is hopeless. And they said, well, we've got his record here and we see that you tried to ditch him at OTU. But they demurred. I said, that's right. He said, well, I really can't see what we can do about it. And I said, well, my crew are just about to rebel. He said, you mean they'll refuse to fly? I said, yes. This hadn't happened, but I thought it might press the point. So he said, well, I'll think about it. We did one cross-country in the Lancaster. The result of the navigational log was such that Cliff was taken off our crew and I was giving a new navigator.
Now, who was your new?
The new navigator was a flight sergeant, Laurie Hough. Laurie Hough. He was the most untidy person I've ever seen. He had long, black, lank hair hanging down across one eye. Never wore a cap. He was untidy. He looked scruffy. And when I asked him his name, he said, Laurie Hough, but you can call me Snake. I thought, my God, what have I got? Frying pan into the fire. Not so. Clough was the greatest navigator I've ever flown with. He was absolutely brilliant. He never flapped. He was spot on. He was just very, very good. Immediately, the crew liked him. These young gunners, hey, this guy's Snake. They idolized him. And, you know, you could trust him. He was absolutely superb. A very strange person. From then on, everything was fine. Our navigational trips, everything we did was great.
Now, there's a couple of notes in your during your time at 165 on HCU. There's a note that aircraft shot down in circuit, and then two aircraft shot down in circuit. This is around this on the 2nd and 3rd of March.
Yeah.
This is presumably German night fighters. Tell us what's going on here.
That particular period, we had gone out on either a long cross country or a spoof raid or something. And there was a system at that time that if German night fighters or intruders were operating over the airfields in the UK against aircraft returning to base, a code signal would be issued on the WT, wireless transmitter, and upon receipt of that, any pilot with navigation lights on in the circuit or about to land would immediately abort. All lights were extinguished, and all the aircraft would proceed to the west coast of England. And there they'd be given the instructions to land at other airfields. The idea being to get the aircraft out of the way from the intruders. On that particular occasion, we had just returned to base and were circling, awaiting our turn to land in the pitch dark, but we would be using navigation lights. When the signal came through that we should hasten away, as it were, which we did, but before we left, we saw a few flashes to the sort of starboard rear, which the rear gunner reported. And we later learnt that two of our aircraft had been shot down in the circuit, one of a number that night. It was a heavy intrusion from Germany of long-range night fighters, and they were lethal, well-practiced. And I think 19 aircraft were lost that night from units as they were trying to land their aircraft.